That's one thing that you learn on your journey as being a martial artist is what looks good on camera is very different from what a real fight is or real combat is.
This is the Action Filmmaking Decoded Podcast. A podcast dedicated to raw action analysis.
Ooh, my gosh. For fans of action cinema out there, how badass would that be?
Each week, we bring you a new action filmmaker to break down your favorite scenes.
360 off person, round kick the guy from a 360 spin.
Now, introducing your hosts, Darren Tun and Mike Messina.
Hello and welcome back to the Action Filmmaking Decoded Podcast. I am your host, Darren Tun.
And I'm your other host, Mike Messina.
And today we have a very special guest, a fellow podcaster. His name is Jerry Haar. He runs a podcast called The Offering, which is a film history podcast. It focuses on horror and other genre films, and every episode is packed with knowledge and personality.
Before we get into the episode, a bit of housekeeping for you. We are on Patreon. So for as little as $1 a month, you can help us support the show if you enjoy our content or want to access our exclusive video breakdowns from Darren and I, then consider supporting us at patreon.com/actionfilmmaking.
Yes. And you can also help us out by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. Just like Jerry Haar did himself, he wrote, "Fans of action cinema, look no further. A fun and informative show that gives listeners a fantastic journey in action cinema of all subgenres. So highly recommended. Big thank you to Jerry Haar for that review." Yeah, Mike, what are some big takeaways from this episode?
It was just a lot of fun kind of sitting back, talking to another person who talks on a podcast for a living. Whenever we get to talk about action and horror together, always really interests me. And we get into it in our discussions with him. Because it seems like horror and action are kind of the opposites of each other, but once in a while, you get something like when we talk about here, Blade, Aliens, or, well, Freddy vs. Jason is an exception. Maybe doesn't do it as well as the others. But seeing them blend together so well and mixing the ability to fight back against the monster, but also be completely disempowered by the monster.
Yeah, I was just really surprised at Jerry's knowledge of all genres, actually. Despite his name being Jerry Haar, he is an actual big action movie fan and knew a lot about, I guess, Hong Kong action cinema, a whole bunch of Hollywood cinema. He had his own opinions about, you know, the way fight scenes are done nowadays, all that stuff. And I think he was also talking a little bit about Donnie Yen, Jackie Chan, Bruce Lee. You have a good conversation about those guys. So yeah, stay tuned for that. And without further ado, here is Jerry Haar.
I think with the John Wick films and to a lesser extent, Atomic Blonde, there became a formula that was very cookie cutter for modern choreography, so to speak.
Yeah, John Wick kind of felt like a lot of Aikido moves, and he was really like throwing people over the back and then flipping them over and then they would be on the ground. And that was just repeated a lot throughout the film, like a lot of just those flips that he was doing with the gun-fu.
Yeah, it is super modern gun-fu. And, you know, with that style, it's like you're a Stone Cold Killer and everything, which is great for that style. But the problem with being a Stone Cold Killer sometimes is that you're Stone Cold and everything's kind of flat and there's no emotional beats like there were in, say, a John Woo film or something like that, where every shot that you fire, every punch that you throw is an emotional statement. It's not just you being super badass James Bond 007 kind of thing. It's part of the story or part of the character going through whatever you're going through.
I mean, I don't want to get into the politically charged world of Hong Kong and Chinese politics because we could be here for 6 hours.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is that the film output that was coming out of Hong Kong in the 90s, not only was it influential, it was incredible, you know? And it was sad to see that go because so much, whether it was John Woo or Jackie Chan or Soo Hark, so much came out of there. And I don't know. I mean, to an extent, you can see it even early on, like Tarantino's like ripping off City on Fire. By the way, just as a side question, did you guys see the last Donnie Yen film that came out?
What was the name of that one?
What was it?
I think it was like Raging Fires or something.
Oh, okay. And the one I saw from him was like him in a fat suit. That was the last one.
Oh my God. Obviously it went over for Chinese audiences. It was like, and that was a remake. The Enter the Fat Dragon was a remake.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, and don't quote me on this, I think Sammo Hung played the original fat, but he's a fat guy.
Yeah. He's an actual, yeah. So makes sense. Yeah, I was surprised. I don't know how that movie did, or I didn't actually see it, but.
I like Donnie Yen a lot. I do. He did more of the dramatic comedic turn with Big Brother, and I thought that was a good look for him. But yeah, this movie, Raging Fire, was a big deal. It was like Benny Chan's last film before he passed away. But I got to be honest with you, it's like, I think Donnie Yen, it might have been Flashpoint, but it also could have been the Ip Man movies, where he just hit like the ceiling of like,
the pinnacle of what it could be, yeah.
I will also say this, and as much as I feel like it's that first film that hits for an action martial artist, whether it's Tony Jaa with Ong Bak, you're just chasing that proverbial dragon, you know, where it's like Jean-Claude Van Damme, Bloodsport. He'll never make another, I hate to say it, and that's not me being negative, but maybe Hard Target because it was John Woo, or Time Cop. But a lot of these stars, even whether it's Bruce Willis, they have that first movie that connects with the audience, and it's hard to transition out of it.
I'm just wondering why that is. Like, why is it so hard for them to transition out? I mean, does the action get any worse? I mean, their choreography shouldn't really change. A lot of the stuff that they're doing is pretty similar, or it should even get better from there. But I don't know. It's
kind of like being characterized, right?
Yeah.
That's something you see with Scott Atkins a lot, who we talked to before. Keeps getting the same kind of sort of B-movie-ish roles where it's not super dramatic or anything like that. It is kind of just straight martial arts action films, which is great. And it's great for people like us who like that kind of thing. But for him, you can tell you can tell because he explicitly says he's trying to break out to be a household name, but he can't make that transition. I feel like he needs to go totally out of left field in order to do that. Take a not martial arts film, do like an indie drama film. That's kind of what he's trying to do.
Yeah, especially with his latest stuff, he's trying to transition out of action a little bit more. But I don't know, he can never reach that like Boyka height that he did before the same way. Yeah.
And you know what? Sometimes though, like we probably would say that about Keanu Reeves too, if it were, you know, 5-10 years ago. Oh, you were in The Matrix. You were in
whatever it is, you can't
come back. And then he comes back with John Wick and he's the biggest thing again now. So once in a while.
It does happen.
I guess
it's not really redefining, but yeah, he's coming back definitely.
I mean, I didn't realize how popular the Boyka films were in like Europe and, you know, Eastern Europe. It's incredible. I mean, but you get typecast, and it's funny because years ago, my parents used to take me to Star Trek conventions before it was cool, when it was really nerdy.
Yeah.
And I got to meet James Doohan, who played Scotty.
Nice.
I was a little kid. I didn't know any better. And I was like, you know, Mr. Doohan, what is it like to be typecast? And like, everybody was like, oh my, I can't believe that he just asked that.
At least you're a kid. And you know, it was like, okay-ish to ask that.
Well, he was smart. He diffused the situation. He was like, why don't you come up here, young lad? Blah, 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 blah. You know, he's gonna have the picture, a photo op with the child.
Yeah.
And he explained to me, he goes, it's a good thing and a bad thing. He goes, it's a good thing when you're looking for work, but it's a bad thing if you want to do something different. You know, Atkins, I thought, and this is the God's honest truth, I thought that he was going to do the Expendables 2, and Pete, that was going to give him a little more exposure to a global audience, you know? Mm-hmm.
If there's a movie to get overshadowed in, might be any Expendables movie.
Yeah.
It's hard. You know, it's not easy. Even, I think some of the easiest ways are, like, obviously Shang-Chi is a very, it's its own thing. There was some choreography in that film that was absolutely incredible, and there was other stuff that didn't connect with me. Not that it wasn't incredible, but I have certain sensibilities when it comes to action. And unfortunately, I think one of the hindrances, it's very hard to put certain things in a PG-13 context. And I know that sounds like a cop-out, you know, good choreography is good choreography, but it falls flat sometimes. You know, one of the guys that I was able to talk to, John Krang, he wrote The Art of Fight Choreography. Great book. Pick it up. John Krang, K-R-E-N-G. Mm-hmm. Fantastic book. And basically, it explains, and which is the theory of all martial arts, is that it's an extension of emotions. It's an extension of storytelling.
Right.
And that's the secret. That's
yeah,
why
to
Rocky
some extent
works.
It should move the story along. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was like the first thing Sam Hargrave kept saying. He was like, story is the most important thing in action. It just can't be, you know, pushed to the side at all. Which is one of the things I feel like people have said about the John Wick films is like, they feel like there's no attachment to that action, even though as like an action fan, I feel very like enthusiastic about John Wick and what they've done with the franchise. A lot of my friends just don't have that same connection with it just because the story isn't there for them. I guess that finding that balance between whether or not it's cool to show on screen and whether or not it shows off the story in a, or moves the story along in a good way.
I think what it is we were even, I saw the new Bond film and we were talking
No Time
about,
to Die, was that?
Yeah. I didn't like it.
Oh, really? I actually haven't seen it yet, but I heard some good reviews about it. So I was a little hyped, but.
Definitely watch it.
Yeah.
Definitely watch it. But that's just my, it. To me, it was like out of a 10, it was a 5 or a 6.
Oh, wow.
Just, you know, but we were talking about when it's been 15 years, 2006 was when the first Casino Royale came out, and they were aping that terrible, terrible, jittery style of fight choreography. That just
Shaky cam, everything. Yeah,
Dude, Snake Eyes. did you see Snake Eyes Origins?
I did not, but I heard it was really, really shaky.
Listen, and I know you probably. I don't care who hears this. That was bad. Shame on everybody involved. You're trying to sell me a ninja movie with terrible fights?
I guess Henry Golding as a fight kind of guy doesn't really do a lot of fighting. He's more of an actor, so he's...
Here's the thing, and I said this to my friends. He's a big collector of the toys. And I said to him, I'm like, you've got this handsome dude. Like, why are you going to take Mr. Handsome and then put a mask on him? And then if we go by the original G.I. Joe thing, Snake Eyes was horribly disfigured. So how are we going to take the handsome guy and make him ugly and then put a mask on him?
I don't know. I have yet to see the action in that, but I don't even know. Like, I'm really not that excited to see it just because of what I've heard so far. And Adkins obviously put out a tweet and he was like shitting on it. Not too thrilled about it. We'll see.
I don't blame you.
But then you got the Jason Bourne movies and that had, you know, some good shaky cam for some people. I guess it was, you know, added to the story a little bit, added to the scene more. I don't know. There's two sides to it, but nobody seems to really do it well. They always say like, oh, we're trying to do like the Jason Bourne style, but it's not. It's just shaky for no reason.
The Jason Bourne style.
Yeah.
It's not something you should try to emulate.
Yeah, yeah. We're trying to do the shaky.
We're trying to make it so you can't see anything and you get seasick watching this. Like, it's been said before, of course, time and time again, but it's to mask the fact that either your choreography isn't there or your actors can't, you know, pull off that kind of choreography. Or it's just, you know, a misled sort of gritty action design choice or action filmmaking choice. Vlad Rimberg, we had him on the show too. He said he sort of mastered it. And you can kind of see in some of his work, some of the shakiness coming through in that different way where he can stabilize it just enough. So you can still tell what's going on. And it's just a bit of an aesthetic thing that you're adding on top of it. But shaky cam's rough, man.
Look, and the reality of it is that everything goes in waves and cycles and trends. It became the same thing. Talking about JCVD again, when he first did that back spinning kick, we can call it 100 different things, call it a back spinning kick, helicopter kick, whatever, 360. Everybody was like, oh, you got to do that. And if you watch even like Rambo 3, like Sylvester Stallone is doing, he's trying to do that kick. And I'm like, what? But that's what happens. And it was the same thing with that trend where it was like, everything is shaky cam. I don't like it because it's jarring and we've seen it. You have to use it as a stylistic choice. Like if you're using it for the edit, that's fine. I'm down with it if it's the transition. Fine.
But yeah, watching that in theaters is rough.
Yeah, no
problem. Especially on the big screen, it's like, I can't even see what's going on.
Just upset.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask too, Jerry, if you could intro yourself a tiny bit, just give the audience a little bit about yourself and what your show is, what kind of movies you're into, if they didn't already get a hint at what we've been talking about through what we've been talking about.
Well, shockingly, my name is Jerry Hara. And also shockingly, my name is because I really enjoy horror films. It was going to be Jerry Romantic Comedy, but that just didn't pan out the way I thought it would. That was a terrible joke. Yeah. Aside from that fact, I have a show called The Offering, just launched this year, just released the season finale, which was episode 25. it took about 7 to 10 episodes to find out, to find my footing as far as the show goes. But the format is very straightforward. It's a deep dive into a specific movie. The overarching theme for most of this season was Scream and the effect it had on mainstream horror, the effect it had on Dimension Pictures at the time. One thing that I've always loved about podcasts, and I enjoy entertainment, I listen to a lot of film podcasts. And one thing that really excites me is there's got to be a mix where it's like 70 to 80% where you're learning and you're actually getting some kind of information, even if it could be about bodybuilding, could be about windsurfing, but it's the information that you desire. That's very important for me. So it became one of these things where now I know for the next season, it's like almost laying out a syllabus. Even my producer, Pete Bune. Hey, Pete Bune. He likes when I say hello. Hi, Pete. He basically told me, he's like, you need to be a professor and you need to teach this because like you're teaching a class. I try to keep the opinion. Well, I mean, the opinion's always there. It depends on what you're trying to get across. But I'm a huge action film fan. Huge, like crazy. So, yeah. And for all of your wonderful listeners out there, I've had a lot of coffee.
Jerry this time, yeah.
Tap in and strap in.
I listened to the show a bunch before, and the sort of monologue, yeah, you're right. It's an educational thing. It's a history podcast as much as it is a film or culture podcast. And I like being brought back to the specific, you know, time and culture and in film history of whatever the topic it may be. I know you covered A24 before, which I'm a big A24 fan, and all the horror films, especially the genre films that come out from there. Covered Jennifer's Body and some other non-horror things as well. I would highly recommend that. And, you know, like you said, big podcast fans here as well. I would recommend, I just started listening to the Script Apart podcast, where the host will take on different screenwriters, interview them, and they'll talk about the first draft of these really popular films and then how that sort of evolved over time. So they've covered Watchmen, they've covered Die Hard, Speed, a lot of great stuff there. So I would highly recommend that, as long as we're on the topic of movie podcasts.
There's a lot of good ones. I mean, it's crazy. Just anything, it's funny because just like everything, like with music, there's very pure expressions of pop. Even when you listen to a pop song, it could be drum and bass. It could be more hip hop leaning. It could be country leaning. So it's we've gotten into this like weird subgenre thing where it's like, do you want a podcast that's about people who enjoy dogs but also want to be ninjas? We've got a podcast. You know, it's very specific.
Yeah, so very, very niche down.
Yeah, that's where we're at.
It is a really weirdly nerdy, almost. It's becoming more mainstream now, definitely. But it was sort of a hipster space to be in. Darren and I were joking, like back in the day, you'd want to be a rock star or an action movie hero or something like that. A couple of years later, many years later, all of a sudden it's like, oh, I want to be a YouTube star. I want to be big on the internet and a blogger.
Yeah.
TikTok star or something. Now it's us nerds saying, man, we really want to be big in the podcast realm.
Very, very neat, like a very, very niche space.
It's the nerdiest dream ever.
Yeah.
But podcasts are great.
You know, it's one of these things too, where I think that it's come full circle and it's a much larger audience. I'm not a fan of a lot of the idiocy that Joe Rogan brings to the table. But to be perfectly honest with you folks, I think he's a moron. Ooh, hot take. But I mean, he's brought it to a much larger audience, you know?
Yeah.
See, look at Apple. Apple, what they're doing right now, it's like, hey, Dave Chappelle, you want a podcast? It's become perfunctory. It's almost like whether you have a link tree or whether you have a business card, the podcast is now a part of your au revoir, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Everyone needs a podcast now. And it is. It's like a staple because it is great for just conveying your personality in a way that is more personal, more directly connecting to people than something like a Twitter feed or something like that. So it makes sense. Makes sense that businesses and bigger corporations and things are looking to get into the realm as well. Happy Halloween. Once again, we will return to the episode in just a second, but first, we have a little giveaway lined up for y'all. So there's this great film called Stillwater that came out a little while ago, packed with emotion and suspense. It follows an American oil rigger traveling to France to visit his estranged daughter in prison for a murder she claims she didn't commit.
hate when that happens. Confronted with language barriers, cultural differences, and a complicated legal system, he soon builds a new life for himself as he makes it his personal mission to exonerate her. This is coming from Academy Award-winning director Tom McCarthy, Academy Award-winning actor Matt Damon, as well as Camille Cotton and Abigail Breslin. It's an edge-of-your-seat story that is available on digital and Blu-ray, complete with bonus content, and you know that we're all about that sweet, sweet BOCO. And we have 5 digital codes for the film for 5 lucky listeners to get for free. I just need you to do 2 things in order to enter this giveaway. So I need you to find the social media post for this very episode on Instagram or Facebook. You can find us at Action Filmmaking Podcast on both. I need you to 1, go ahead and share the post on either platform, and 2, leave a comment on either platform with your favorite action horror movie. And that's it. We'll announce the winners on next week's episode, so if you enter by then, you're in the giveaway. Now, back to the show. Also wanted to talk about movies at some point during this podcast.
So yes.
Steer over to that a little bit. I know one movie that we talked about discussing today was Blade, with the whole theme of action and horror coming together.
Wesley Snipes. Stephen Dorff.
You're one of them, aren't you?
No. I'm something else.
Blade.
If anyone hasn't seen it, 1998 release, starring Wesley Snipes, big, one of the first Marvel superhero movies to come out. Director Stephen Norrington, writer David S. Goyer. I'm going to kick off to Jerry first, actually. Tell me what you think about Blade. What comes to mind?
Okay. I'm just going to give it to you down and dirty, folks. I got to give you the whole rub because Blade not only kicks off, it's the first Marvel film that's profitable. It's their first real foray into the game. Also, secondly, because I just got to get this off my chest, Wesley Snipes had always shown that he could do some martial arts. Like, you know, he'd throw a sidekick or, you know, he'd throw some hand combinations. But this was the first movie where it was like, oh, dude, Wesley Snipes is bad. Like, he's a bad man. Like, he's doing everything. He's doing capoeira in this film. My experience, just to kick this off, was I saw Blade the night it came out. And you have to understand, rave culture was very big. 1999 was just a very different magic. Was it 98?
It was 98. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
98 was just a very different time. I saw it with a bunch of friends, with my one friend, and we said, was it me or that was like the best thing you've ever seen? We came back that night for a midnight show with 4 other friends. And that's perfect word of mouth. We waited for them to get off of work so we could go see it again. And I think just that simple story is a testament to why that film works, because we had never seen anything that so seamlessly, and I'll argue that we haven't seen anything like it since, that it seamlessly melded the worlds of action cinema with horror in a very delicious Reese's peanut butter cup way.
Reese's peanut butter cup. That's a good way to describe it. And you're right. And it is such a testament to how innovative it was, or how much of a first it was, that now we've cycled through the superhero genre and now we're claiming that we're breaking new ground with things that Blade already did. If it's having a black lead with Black Panther, although that's still awesome and something that Darren and I talk about still, Wesley Snipes did it with Blade however many years ago, talking about Deadpool, how it's awesome that it's an R-rated superhero and that's something we've never really seen before. Blade did it that many years ago. So it really is. And like you're saying too, blending the horror and action genres. Usually, if you're pitching to me a horror movie and then you talk about action elements to it, I'll sometimes kind of lose you. Because a lot of the times when you're watching a true blue horror movie, then you get to the third act and then all of a sudden the monster's not scary anymore because now we're fighting back and we're having an effect on it, and it just loses that appeal. But having a property where it is melding both worlds together from the foundations up, that's when you start to have that Reese's peanut butter cup effect. I'm going to kick it to you.
This wasn't the first time. If we go back really into 1982, there was a film with Chuck Norris called Silent Rage. Now, Silent Rage essentially is a slasher film with the incredibly wooden acting of Chuck Norris. And it's ridiculous. Like, they got the guy who played Bluto from Animal House. And they're like, hey, he's a fat, funny guy. He'll be your partner. So it's a comedy that's a slasher movie. And they were trying to, because at that time you had 82 was really the zenith of the slasher film in American cinema. The reality of it was well, we'll take martial arts. And what if it's Michael Myers, but it's Chuck Norris? The problem was they didn't have a good killer. Mm. And they didn't have a Michael Myers or a Jason. So it just came off just very, you know, like wooden, and it didn't work. And that's really... It's hard to say action fantasy. You talk about like Zoo Warriors and like the Wuxi films. That's a whole nother subgenre. But even like action fantasy, like what we had, like Big Trouble in Little China. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know. That might be racist now. I'm not even sure if that film, I have to go back and watch it again.
Yeah.
But
what was that film about? What was that?
That was a John Carpenter picture with Kurt Russell. And essentially, okay. Yeah, he goes into Chinatown in San Francisco, and there's this evil demonic who, let me tell you something, Big Trouble in Little China. I do love this movie. I'm thinking about all the great, James Hong is in it. James Hong plays roles. Just got his star on the Walk of Fame. He's great. He's the best. I mean, if I could afford James Hong for a movie, I don't care. Like, let him, he could play anything. He's great. But I guess what I'm trying to get at with Blade is that no one had blended these worlds so particularly well. The fight scenes hold up. Some of the CGI obviously does not hold up.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of the practical effects look really, really good, though. The stuff that they actually built and then designed themselves. And then, like, when it switched over to the CGI, it was just, like, totally different. It was, like, a little wacky. Like, you know what we're talking about? Like, the blood pooling into their heads and then the explosions and stuff like that. Some of it looked okay, but then some of it I was like, damn, what's going on there?
Yeah.
But, it's funny. Because in the sequel, in Blade 2, not to skip ahead, but Guillermo del Toro then goes for a lot more practical in that second film because of that. I think that's a reaction. The choreography is just so on point, because even like we're talking about the second film, there's a point where like he back body drops a guy. He does a bunch of wrestling moves. And I was just like, that's good choreography. Like whenever you can take something. And in the first Blade film, we get into some of the capoeira, which is the only film that's really showcased. It was only the strong. And I can never say his name, Mark Dacascos. I love him. Okay. He's great. I mean, I've Brotherhood of the Wolf. I've been following him Drive, not the Ryan Gosling Drive, but the Drive with Kadeem Hardison. Yeah. He's fantastic. Like he was just recently in John Wick 3, but you just, you know, Donnie Yen is in the second Blade too.
Yeah.
It changes the game, and it doesn't even know that it's doing it, because it's a hard R film with a black lead. Okay. You've got a black lead, martial arts, it's a horror film. And New Line Cinema was just like, they made it and they were like, this is really good, but they had cold feet. They're like, is anybody going to get this movie? And in 98, to have an African American lead and all these pieces in place. You know, even I got to say, one of the best things going for Blade, I forget the actor's name, Stephen Dorff. Thank you. He's a great villain. Udo Kier. You've got a lot of good people in this movie. But like even Wesley Snipes, like he fights that little girl. There's that scene where why is he fighting this child? Well, I found out. Because I'm a nerd.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was a big Taekwondo star. And he was just like, well, this girl's got moves. So Wesley Snipes had enough stroke then, who was like, I found this little girl who can do these crazy kicks. And
Put her in there.
100% it's called Taekwondo.
Yeah.
First thing I thought of when I saw it, because I've done a lot of Taekwondo. That's my primary martial arts background. So that just screen. And then after defending for, I don't know, 30 seconds of screen time, he just grabs the leg and kind of just smacks her.
smacks her right across the face or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Good moment.
That whole entire set reminded me of that John Wick 3 glass case set. Yeah. I don't know if it did for you guys as well.
It was very Police Story, because Police Story with Jackie Chan set up that. Police Story 2, where he's in the mall and it's just like, how can I break the most glass?
No.
That's why I love that movie.
Yeah, I also realized when he was throwing that police officer guy around, he would just like ruin the most stuff. Like he would just wreck everything. And I was like, this is so unnecessary.
Yeah. The girl, Karen's character said that. And she's like, is that necessary? And yeah. I wasn't sure if she meant, do you need to rough him up that much? Or if she meant, why are you breaking all my shit? Like, chill out.
Yeah, yeah.
Chill out, Wesley Snipes. All my books.
You know, and it's funny because nowadays we don't even have, a lot of times you have an action set piece. And I just saw the trailer for Uncharted with Tom Holland and Mark Wahlberg.
Mark Wahlberg, yeah. Oh, wow.
And they're creating that scene from the game. I forget whether it was the second or the first. They all blur. It's the scene where there's cargo coming out of the back of the plane and he's jumping. Mm. And I'm like, once you get to these big CGI action sequences, and another example of that was recently Black Widow with the Sky Fortress. Mm. It's they do the pre-visualization for these big set pieces. And I will take Blade. I'll take Jackie Chan and Police Story any day with practical glass than on a green screen. Like go back, even if we go back and you watch the stuff from like the Star Wars prequels, it's just disconnected. That's the problem. I think a lot of it was when you had an action movie like Blade, Wesley Snipes is very hands-on and very protective. And, you know, as you get to Blade Trinity, he then has problems with Goyer, who directs the third movie. He also has problems with the studio because he's trying to protect his baby. I mean, I've also heard, and this is just rumors, I always heard that Wesley Snipes is a bit of a diva, you know?
I did hear some rumors that he was a little hard to work with. Something happened there, I forget, but just read something about that.
It is what it is. I mean, the other thing too is people forget that he came up really in the late 80s and it was different dealing. There used to be more of a power base. The actor, whether it was Sylvester Stallone, would have a lot more power over their characters and more say. It goes back to even stuff like Burt Reynolds, Bruce Lee, where eventually you get a certain amount of clout where you can control the production. And the reality of it was that as film was changing, and we get by the time you get to Blade 3, you understand the modern climate of cinema in general is that intellectual properties matter more than story or characters. Mm-hmm. It's how are we going to sell this? And and Blade is, to me, even now, just to skip ahead, I think it's Mahershala Ali has been cast as the new Blade. Yep. I mean, I don't know. I'm not trying to be a stick in the mud here, but Mahershala Ali, he better go learn some karate. You better go do something. One last point I wanted to make with Taekwondo, I'm backing it up again. Mm-hmm. Two of my favorite martial artists are the Ri brothers. Okay. Philip Ri from Best of the Best. Him and his brother basically took over Simon Ri. They do choreography for everything. It's funny because even when I watch their choreography, as much as I admire the both of them, they're Taekwondo guys, Hapkido guys. So they obviously, okay, and this is another hot take. If I have my choice, if it's Taekwondo or Hapkido, I'm going for Hapkido because there's jujitsu and wrist locks in there.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm done. I'm done. That's it.
Just going to leave that here and then back out.
Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. I don't hear a whole lot of conversation around Hapkido, to be honest. A lot of people kind of skip it. Of course, Taekwondo is the Korean one that everyone knows. Flashy kicks and the flippy dips and such.
I mean, at that point, you know, when you talk about the origins of Taekwondo, it was very much about national pride. Mm-hmm. So part of that is the showmanship that you see, especially in Wushu. I mean, we just talk about how practical is Wushu. It's very practical when you know what you're doing. But there's also a part of it that is very much flamboyant dance. And that's fine.
Yeah, that's where Wushu comes from, is the performance side of martial arts. I think technically Wushu is another catch-all term similar to the term Kung Fu, just the performative version of any style there is. So yeah, I see what you're saying. Do you have any kind of like a time constraint or anything too?
No, I'm off today, which is good. I'm helping my friend. He just had a baby, him and his wife. So I'm doing a haunted house for them.
On brand.
Yeah. I would do security for the houses, but I haven't like been a scare actor in like a decade. It's funny too, because, you know, I'm a scarecrow and I come to life and I jump out. There's a bunch of scarecrows and I jump off the thing. And there's a metal plate by where the staging is. So I just started dropping a 10-pound weight and it makes a big boom. Mm-hmm. And that's what scares the people. I don't scare them. It's that loud noise. I forgot it. It's a cheap gimmick. Mm-hmm. It's like doing a haunt is like the most base form of like acting. It's like, what can you do to elicit a reaction from someone?
Yeah, in the most visceral way. Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. And jump scares in films, I know a lot of people hate them, but I've done a lot of really oddly meticulous thinking about what makes it good. I think it really comes down to what the purpose of the jump scare is and how it can sort of reset your brain to reassess that rhythm. And so the director or whoever the filmmaker is can say, okay, we know there was a lot of tension. Now we can stop, have a payoff, and then rebuild that tension. So now with that purpose in mind, that's how I was able to answer the question for myself for why do we have these false jump scares? Like, why is it such a trope that you think something's there and then the cat moves and then it's not actually any kind of threat? That's why. It's to control the rhythm and the pacing of the scene. So you can keep building up tension, but then not have to completely blow all of it. So you can have a little bit of relaxation and then keep that audience interested and engaged.
It's also misdirection. Misdirection, which is the same thing that correlates with fighting. Fighting in general, you know, is like we talk about a feint. You know, it's something that's not meant to connect. It's only meant to confuse the opponent. My favorite guy who's doing jump scares right now is James Wan. James Wan is a goddamn master of the jump scare.
he started with The Conjuring, right? Don't get me started
because after I loved Malignant because it was like a cheesy movie and that had a lot of great fight choreography.
Oh, really?
Really? I got to see that then. It's still on
Malignant.
The list.
Yeah, it's not for everybody.
That's the new one that came out, right?
I hear divisive things about it, definitely.
You are correct.
Yeah.
But James Wan, you know, people talk about, they say, oh, Wes Craven, John Carpenter. James Wan is now that guy. And I don't care if they're going to give him his flowers or not. But the reality of it is he made an Aquaman movie that made $1 billion. Who saw that coming?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
James Wan is the modern master of horror. And it's like people be like, well, no. No, because he's done, whether it's Insidious, whether it's The Conjuring, there's nobody that's been as consistent for the last decade or 20 years. If I wasn't doing what I'm doing right now, I'd be running a James Wan fan club. It's kind of like, welcome back to Wan Talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be a good name for it.
They're writing that down.
Yeah.
Wan Talk, that's good. So Wan over an Ari Aster or a Robert Eggers or someone like that.
Okay, so that's a difficult question because the reality of it is James Wan, I think, makes films that are very much like a good hamburger.
Yes, definitely.
They're exactly what you want. You know what you're getting into. I think that Ari Aster he's on another level. He's on a different level where it's more of like kind of the David Cronenberg guys. Like David Cronenberg dealt a lot with body horror. Not the same thing, but the reality of that, he's kind of creating his own lane.
Yeah.
Like in the same way as we were talking about M. Night Shyamalan, you know, love him or hate him, he's got his own lane. And that's cool. Mm-hmm.
So Ari is the guy that did Hereditary, right?
Oh, yeah.
At Midsommar, yeah. Very, very different kind of horror.
that goes into the genre of elevated horror.
Mm.
And there are people within the horror community that absolutely hate elevated horror. I'm more of a buffet style guy where I like it all. I think it's all, you know, and that's even what we used to talk about martial arts. Martial arts are like villains. Beets have nutritional value. Carrots have nutritional value. It doesn't matter what style you choose. It matters that you have an art and you embrace it. So much has changed. So much has changed. You know, like I came from the days of the 80s and 90s where Ninja Turtles and the Karate Kid, there were dojos opening everywhere and nobody really knew what was going on. And then mixed martial arts comes along and that changes everything. I mean, I've been a martial artist my entire life. And I remember it was like, it exposed this huge, basically plot hole in your own style. Where it's like, what's your ground game? Do you have a ground game? It's like, don't have it. You know,
yeah,
Ishin Ru is not going to teach you. Taekwondo is not going to give you that ground game. I think, though, and I will say this to any young martial artists out there, you got to start with a root style. You got to, you know, see it through, get your black belt or, you know, your sash, whatever it is. And then from the root style, you can kind of
branch out.
You, You need that base. You need it.
You can't be jumping around and doing all these different things at once. I haven't seen a lot of jiu-jitsu in movies, though. Maybe it's just me.
It's not exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, wrist locks and stuff aren't exciting. It's even, we talk about Steven Seagal where, you know, I've studied Aikido and it's one of those things where you think to yourself, like, this is not cinematic, but hey, he had a pretty decent run. If you go down the Steven Seagal rabbit hole, this becomes the Steven Seagal episode. But I guess what I'm trying to say is it really depends on how you portray the art on screen. And I go back, especially because of the Blade thing, like Wesley Snipes was very influenced, I think, even by Jean-Claude Van Damme. Mm. And whether you think he's a good martial artist, whether you think he's a good actor, which is ridiculously questionable. It's also the very loose definition of actor in the loosest sense, but the reality
show a lot of emotion. Yeah.
he knows how, and that's why we go back to Bruce Lee. He's able to communicate emotion through the fight choreography, but he knew where to put the camera. Mm-hmm. And that's the reality of it is like, you can have somebody who's like an amazing martial artist, you know, like, and they know acupressure and everything else, but does it look good on screen? Does it translate to a cinematic? That's one thing that you learn on your journey as being a martial artist is, and something that I had to learn was what looks good on camera is very different from what a real fight is or real combat is.
Yeah. And I think it's like we were saying with jiu-jitsu before, it's like, it doesn't always look great on camera, but I mean, it's probably the most practical, like Mike and I were talking about in terms of martial arts and self-defense, that and Muay Thai.
Yeah, you saw that in the early UFC days, literally the first UFC days. That's why the UFC was created. It was so that jiu-jitsu could kind of show its thing, and it did show its thing. It was just the smaller Gracie guy coming in, beating on the larger guys of basically any other style. And I think that is sort of maybe why we see guys like Keanu Reeves or Tom Cruise doing their own fights and stunts a little bit more, is because we've now compartmentalized the world of martial arts a bit more, where there is the super Eastern traditional martial arts, some would say woo-woo, some would say, you know, meditative, whatever you want to call it. But now that is kind of separate from the guys who are jacked with their shirts off, just fighting each other in the cage in the UFC, which I love both worlds, of course. But now I think people see that and they say, oh, okay, I don't need to be this super, you know, meditative Zen monk to be able to pull off these kicks. I can just go and stretch and work out and then be able to do it. And now we're seeing that. We're seeing actors trying to do it themselves.
About a decade ago, I had never studied any form of formal Chinese martial arts. I had studied everything, you know, Filipino, Japanese, but never Chinese Kung Fu. I started doing Wing Chun. And the reality of it was it's a totally different, at first you feel like an octopus. You're like, what am I doing? But ultimately, I think a lot of Wing Chun practitioners could go up against any good boxer. But aside from that, I guess what I was trying to get with the Wing Chun is when you have these older disciplines, when UFC really emerged as this big thing, kids were like, oh, I don't want to learn a traditional martial art. I want the smorgasbord of everything. And ultimately, we did see that a lot in cinema. I think the best example was that film with Tom Hardy, Warrior, because that was a good movie. That was a drama and it had a heartfelt story. I guess to a lesser extent, it was Scott Adkins, was, you know, with the Boyka films. It's kind of like the real big.
It's true. It's true.
Undisputed too, with Michael Jai White. He's great too. He's another guy. Oh, if we're going back to that 1997 black lead, Michael Jai White and Spawn, which was a terrible film.
Shout out to Spawn. Oh my God.
I've not seen Spawn, but judging from the reaction here, I can tell something's up.
Spawn is, I don't think I sat through the whole movie, but I am definitely familiar with the character and Todd McFarlane's whole shtick that he's got. He who is the comic creator for Spawn. Seems like it was just an excuse for him to draw really cool capes in all the panels, but
he likes capes.
He does like capes. Crazy, super R-rated kind of content there. For everything Spawn and Spawn related. So yeah, with that segue, I guess let's circle back to Blade. One thing I did want to mention, maybe not about the action itself, but there's a spoiler alert here for the last act of the movie where Blade meets his mom and vampires don't age. His mom's a vampire now, so she's still kind of young. And there's this really weird tension between.
Yeah, I was like, are they going to kiss? What the hell is going on here?
Made me a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's also weird that his mom didn't age, like you were saying, and she's still a vampire. So it's like.
And it did come out of nowhere, like weird sexual tension aside.
Yeah.
It's like just the pod opened up for the bad guy's bedroom, and then just his mom is there. Totally came out of nowhere. I feel like they didn't really set it up a whole lot. It was
now looking back, I'm not sure what the purpose of the mom being there was, but
that's the thing too. I feel like they set up a lot of things with not so great of payoffs or no payoff. Like when he goes to what's his name, Whistler, he's like, oh yeah, Whistler, he has cancer. That means he might die soon and it's gonna make me real sad. But then they just have the bad guys kill him off. And it's almost like the disease part or the smoking part was not a factor at all. So I don't know why they had that emotional beat there. And then to contrast that, you have the sword thing, right? So the sword, the payoff or the setup is that if anyone grabs it who isn't Blade, then it'll pop out blades from the handle and cut your hand off. And they had two or three different payoffs for that. So I thought that was really well done. And then other times it kind of just falls flat in that regard. And he had that weird line at the end about people trying to ice skate uphill. And that was his cool Blade one-liner at the end.
It's so bad that it's amazing. Like it transcends.
Yeah.
It's terrible that it's amazing.
It is memorable. But some of it really.
I have a question for you guys because this has been burning in the back of my mind since 1998. Okay.
Oh my God.
After Whistler dies, he grabs that plant and he takes the sword and he cuts the roots off.
Oh my God. Yes.
Was that just supposed to be like symbolic? Was it just stupid? Like now that I don't have my roots, I can kill. I can kill without consequence because.
As if he didn't do that before. I thought I missed something.
Me too. I was like, there's something going on with the plant here, but I'm just going to accept it. I don't really know exactly what it is. So that was the metaphor? Was that what it is? That he cut the roots and that's why? Okay.
I mean, you know, there's obvious nods to other films with Blade, like the Shaft films with Richard Roundtree.
Mm.
You know, because it's a cool dude and he's got a black trench coat. It's very, we got a lot of trench coats. And you know what? We'll go back, bring it full circle. John Woo, our good friend. Oh my God, the actor's name again, Chow Yun-Fat.
Oh, Chow Yun-Fat, yeah.
He was the OG with the trench coat. I think he was like the first dude who really was like made it.
Was that
cool.
Hard-boiled? What was that?
That was Hard-boiled.
Okay. Yeah. And that came out how many years before Blade? What's that?
Oh, that's the late 80s.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Yeah, that's like late 80s, the whole John Woo, Chow Yun-Fat like renaissance.
Yeah.
But it's crazy. And then like, it's funny, I'm thinking about this too. 1999, a year later, you get The Matrix, and that's trench coated up too.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like The Matrix probably took a lot of inspiration from both of these films because Blade came before The Matrix. Yeah,
I do feel like they're so close together. It might have been that they were filming at the same time. So maybe it was.
You think so?
The same headspace. Like they came to the same conclusion. But then you also have X-Men coming out and step in the right direction again for comic book movies. But they kind of just took that 90s general black leather suit aesthetic and then applied it to the X-Men. And then we you know, evolved from there, of course, but still pivotal steps in that.
Oh, yeah. Have you guys heard about the Eternals, the Chloe Zhao film?
Yeah.
I'm hearing crazy things. And the first thing I thought to myself, I'm like, maybe it's like X-Men, where, you know, you're telling this emotionally dramatic story. Because I've seen this trailer like three times and I'm not interested at all.
Really? We talked about Angelina Jolie and how it was a little odd that she was in there.
That weirds me out. So, it makes me so uncomfortable to see Angelina Jolie in a Marvel movie like that.
Yeah, but it's a really interesting cast, I would say. And now Harry Styles is in there. I heard something about that too. So I don't really know.
We'll see. Notable director.
Yeah, so notable director. Definitely know that Chloe Zhao can produce something pretty cool. But the movie itself, I'm not sure about exactly.
Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic. That's, I mean, get some hot Marvel talk. The other day they were talking about that the Multiverse of Madness, the Doctor Strange film, that's going to be the launching pad for mutants. And I'm kind of I could see it. But my question to the both of you is this. If they're going to bring in the mutants to the new MCU, like, do they do it where it's like, I think it would be cheap if they were like, we opened up this portal and now there's mutants. Like, or if it was like, we've been, you know, the Eternals could even be, they could be planting the seeds of what the mutants were. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's a lot of ways to do it, but let's face it, the next decade, obviously they're in a building phase right now, like rebuilding from what happened. You know, obviously we lost characters in the Avengers films. It's kind of interesting where this is all going, but how are they going to introduce the mutants? What do you guys think?
That's a good question. I mean,
I didn't even think about Doctor Strange at the beginning. So now that's like something I'm thinking about right now.
Doctor Strange is so handy because I've heard speculation too about how he has a big role in the third Spider-Man movie, the third, you know, Spider-Man focused movie, and how it's kind of sort of coinciding with the end of the contract between Sony and Marvel. So if they, for whatever reason, had to totally change up the way Spider-Man interacts with the rest of the universe, they just so happened to plan the story to fall on a big universe, blowing up the continuity, sort of a Doctor Strange storyline to coincide with that, just in case something business-wise might go sideways or they might need to make some adjustments. Same kind of concept here with the Multiverse of Madness being a great just natural reset point to do whatever they need to if they had to do something kind of cheaply but quickly and efficiently. I'm most worried about, you know, X-Men has always been this sort of civil rights allegory, this allegory for any kind of people ever who have been...
If you've been marginalized in any way,
exactly.
Yeah.
And I always say, you know, X-Men, I think it was X2 comes out with Bobby. Gay rights, not something that's mainstream at all. And then you have this scene where Bobby's coming out to his parents, not about his sexuality explicitly, it's about being a mutant, but I mean, just swap out a couple of nouns there, and you have the first coming out scene in a blockbuster hit ever, and it's from X-Men, it's from Marvel, so that is incredible. I don't know if they're going to be able to fit all of that into the MCU at this point, and you know, they try to get some of that social commentary in with something like a Black Panther or a Shang-Chi, but it's so hard to square that off with all of the other checkboxes that they need to mark. It would be interesting to me to see if the X-Men or the mutants were sort of in hiding or something like that throughout. I know that's also something that the Eternals has to score off too, of you were here when all this shit was going down for the past 20,000 movies. Why didn't you do anything? But it would be interesting to me if the X-Men were being marginalized or were scared of being marginalized in the past. And so they were sort of forced to take a backseat or something like that. Or if Professor X wanted them to sort of stay in hiding and wait for the right time, something like that?
It goes in phases. And I think with Shang-Chi, it was very much, this is magic. Now we're into the world of mysticism and magic. And for whatever reason, there's just been a lot of hot goss about all this Marvel stuff. They've been trying to get Keanu Reeves as Ghost Rider for like the last 5 or 6 years. Like Kevin Feige, it's on record. Like you can double confirmed, triple confirmed. And I think what it is Keanu Reeves makes those motorcycles. I think it's Arc.
He does that Squarespace sort of ad deal or whatever, and he's doing motorcycles and whatnot. So yeah, he seems like the perfect fit if you were to do a Ghost Rider kind of thing, I feel like.
What ends up happening is, okay, so if we've gotten into the world of mysticism and magic, it's, you know, Shang-Chi did it, we're into Doctor Strange too. As we get into this, maybe this is how you open the door for Blade. You know, you're like, oh, well, there's... Because whenever we get that, not the living vampire, but I don't know, I've just got this bad feeling about Morbius, Sony's Morbius with Jared Leto, the living vampire. They've delayed it, but it's kind of like, do we start, now that we've got mysticism, can we introduce monsters? Now, like in the MCU, are we gonna, obviously if we're introducing Blade, we've got vampires. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I feel like the way it goes is like Guardians of the Galaxy is like the big space opera intergalactic stuff that brings you the cosmic Marvel. With these films right now, it's the mysticism. I think what's next is perhaps even exploring the world of horror. And ultimately, from a financial point of view, it's the mutants. That's where, because that's the end game. Those films were so successful. People forget, like, I even forget sometimes like how many X-Men films there were, and some of them are fantastic and others not so much.
Yeah, others not so much. That's true. But there were a lot of them, and it's famously their continuity is all over the place. But part of me thinks that's, I don't know if continuity is the biggest deal in movies the way we like to make it out to be. I kind of just want a good movie from start to finish. And I think some of the later X-Men movies were able to do that because they just said, Logan especially, like, there's just such a huge time jump. And you have, I think that's the second version of Caliban that we saw in the X-Men franchise. But they just said, we have a story to tell and we're going to tell it. But yeah, I'm interested to see, obviously, the whole opening realms thing for the MCU. Definitely going to open up some doors to insert some other.
As it was said in Twin Peaks, your favorite flavor of gum will come back into style.
Oh,
and yeah. We're coming full circle now with where in 98 we've got Blade and now we're about to hit 2022.
It's happening again.
Yeah. Blade's coming back again. Like I said, I would love to see, as like something that I always wanted. And I mean, like, Jackie Chan kind of did it with like Armor of God, stuff like that. I want to see like an adventure movie or, you know, something like an Indiana Jones where there's a lot of martial arts. That would be fun. I don't know why we haven't done that yet.
I want to see everything with more martial arts. I keep saying I want an Edgar Wright style movie with someone like Scott Atkins who can add this incredible acrobatic element to the very rhythmic and obviously, you know, signature
that mixture of from comedy and action, right?
That too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We definitely need it.
Yeah. And we talked about, I forget, was it Andy Chang who was talking about the cycles of action movies and how we might be over the hill with martial arts and how they're kind of on the downhill in terms of popularity. But I feel like they're definitely going to come back into style. I think Shang-Chi is going to be a big step in that. But, like you just said, it's going to bounce back and keep oscillating back and forth over the years or over the decades, however long those cycles are going to be.
I think the pendulum culturally and cinematically is about to swing back. We had a lot of films where like Endgame was just this all-encompassing, omnipresent, money-making machine. And I think that we've hit the apex with that quite personally. And I think those films will continue and they will be successful. And there's always a place for spectacle. It's always a wonderful thing. I love big budget crap, just like everybody else. But ultimately, believe it or not, I think it was Tuesday night, I saw Venom, Let There Be Carnage. I'm going to call it Venom 2 because it's a bad movie. And it's funny because the whole movie is a romantic comedy about Tom Hardy and Venom. And even when the film was sold to China, it did very well, almost did $1 billion. In China, it's a comedy. Go look at the press material for the Chinese release of Venom, and it's like it's sold as a comedy. It's a romantic comedy mixed with a universal horror movie, universal monsters movie. Mm-hmm. It is such an oddity. But we're sitting there, and the five trailers that come before it are like all like indie dramas and like thrillers. And I think when I was talking about that pendulum, it's swinging back into, we're going to get real actors, we're going to get stories and drama. Maybe this is just me putting that, but I don't think so. Like, I saw a trailer for Licorice Pizza. It's the new Paul Thomas Anderson film. You know, I saw a trailer for like another drama. You've got Last Night in Soho is coming out this week, the new Edgar Wright film.
Mm-hmm. And that's this week. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Excited. I mean,
Dune comes out this week too.
Yeah.
Heard good things about Dune. We talk about him way too
much. Villeneuve, whatever.
We're still not sure if we're saying his name right. But
yeah. We're just saying it. Yep.
I think that's Villeneuve.
Villeneuve.
Got some bells in that name.
But yeah, Blade Runner was crazy. So yeah, high hopes for Dune.
Look, and this is the crazy thing. It's about to premiere on HBO Max at 6 p.m. Shout out to HBO Max because, like, you know, nerds like me, we plan our day around when these movies drop. And it's like HBO is like 6 p.m. nerds, be here. Like, they tell you.
Yeah.
Like, it was very nebulous recently when Halloween Kills dropped on like Peacock. It's like, well, is it coming out at midnight? Is it coming out at 8? So for any of the programming people that are listening right now for streaming services, let us know. Like Disney Plus, like I need to know, like when it's like Falcon and the Winter Soldier, Hawkeye, whatever. When it drops, let me know. I don't want, you know, like 12 a.m. because a lot of times we're like, oh, yeah, it's going to be on tomorrow. But that's 3 a.m. Eastern time.
It was 3 a.m. Yeah. So I was like waiting that night and I was like, it's not really worth it because when this finishes, it'll be like 4. So
episodes or whatever that show is.
I guess they're expecting people to wake up the next day and then see it there. But yeah, people are crazy. So we'll wait until the a.m.
Yeah. All the streaming programmers in the audience. That's half our audience.
That's all streaming executives.
Yeah.
Those boys on the podcast said we got to drop it like it's hot.
Yeah.
Honestly, if they listen to a few more fan-centric podcasts, that'd probably not be the worst thing for them. Mm. I wanted to talk about aliens a little bit, too.
How could they cut the power, man? They're animals.
There's movement all over the place.
5 meters, man. 4.
Aliens. This time, it's war.
Alien, some background on that. 1986 release, starring Sigourney Weaver.
Yes.
Directed by James Cameron. Sequel, of course, to Alien, which came out before. I don't know what year Alien came out, but it came out before the sequel. Darren, I'm going to kick it to you first to give us some of your thoughts on Aliens.
I don't know. This is like a movie I've seen quite a while ago, and then I just had to rewatch some of those scenes just to get a refresher about it. But I felt like the crew really had good chemistry together. Like, it was just a really fun crew to follow and go with. And I feel like this movie in particular gave a lot more character development to Sigourney Weaver's character than the other movies did. Yeah, I don't know. It's like there was a YouTube video that said that there was some backstory that showed that she used to be a mother. And then when she was in the cryo or something like that, her daughter died, got old, died and whatever. So that relationship with her and the younger girl became even more powerful. I didn't really know that, but that's pretty cool to also hear too.
Yeah,
but
that was like a deleted scene that they included, I think, in the special edition or whatever they called the extended cut. Yeah, they did Interstellar many years before Interstellar did Interstellar. Mm,
yeah.
And I also heard that James Cameron, he wanted to film all of the sort of bantery, lighthearted scenes between all the colonial Marines at the end after they filmed everything else so that they would have all had, all the actors had as much on-set time together as possible to bond together. So then when you actually film those scenes over, you know, the breakfast table or whatever it is, then they already have that chemistry going.
I didn't know that's where it came from, actually. Now watching it back, the whole knife game where it goes like between the fingers, I was like, we always used to do that in high school where, you know, you take the pencil and you do that. And I was like, where did that come from? And now watching back Aliens, I was like, wow. And it was the AI that, or like the AI guy that did the actual knife thing. Yeah. And that, and they didn't even know. Right.
What does he say? He prefers artificial person or something like that.
Yeah.
I think it's artificial person. But famously, this movie is a little more action-centric than Alien, the first one. And that's true, it is. But it's still so horror, so suspenseful because the odds are stacked against our characters so much, despite them being Marines with flamethrowers and smart guns and turrets and stuff like that. And then on top of that, too, it's just a testament to the design of the xenomorphs and the facehuggers. So horrifying and so unique too. Nowadays, you see so many monsters and they have the same general sort of aesthetic. If you're watching, you know, Stranger Things, or if you're watching the John Krasinski one that, what's it called? Not Don't Breathe.
Quiet Place.
That's the one. The one, the other one where you can't make noise.
Yeah.
All those monsters have the same general aesthetic, but then the xenomorphs coming out. And the way that they sort of expanded on the way that the monsters work here, I feel like, again, if you were to tell me, here's a horror movie, the sequel, that's going to add guns in action, and also we're going to tell you more about the monster, I'd say, get that out of here. That's the opposite direction I want a horror movie to go. But of course, James Cameron knows what he's doing. He's able to expand on what's already there and bring out some of the better elements of it, just with a bit of a more action focus. And every element that we added in terms of how we understand the aliens to work with the queen and the egg laying, things like that, it all worked. It added more elements, but it added more elements that still had a mystique to them where it didn't over-explain it, didn't have to over-explain it. And it just made sense given what we already know about these creatures from the first film. Obviously, if you didn't know this movie, I'd say it's pretty good. A controversial opinion. Not really controversial opinion. But
I mean, the original Alien, 1979, which is Ridley Scott, I think even Roger Ebert called it this. This is like the greatest haunted house movie ever made in outer space. And with Aliens, you go to a complete... it's still science fiction. It's still a monster movie, but it's an action film. And it veers right hard. Like, it's a hard right. And now we've got space marines and guns, and it changes the trajectory of the franchise but it also changes the trajectory of how you make a sequel, where it's kind of the same thing, but we're going to do some, I guess the key word I'm looking for is escalation. Karate Kid, again, we're bringing it back to the Karate Kid. In the first Karate Kid, they're fighting in a tournament. And it's like, well, you know, nothing really bad is going to happen. The stuff that's bad that happens is outside of the tournament. But when you get to the second Karate Kid movie, they're in alleged Okinawa, which was really Hawaii, but allegedly Okinawa. That should have been the caption, allegedly. It's escalation where he's fighting Chosen, and now there's no rules. There's no tournament. So my favorite sequels, and Aliens is one of my favorite sequels. I think it reinvents the entire first film in a different, beautiful way. It's just crazy because that's what a good sequel should be. Should be what you liked last time, but what are the stakes and how can we raise them? And it's funny because Cameron can't even get away from Aliens. If you watch Avatar, there's so many of those same elements. You know, like Giovanni Ribisi pretty much plays the same character that Paul Reiser is playing, where it's like the corporate scumbag who's going to screw everybody. You know, there are those tropes, but I think pound for pound, Aliens might be one of the best sequels ever made. That's just, you know.
Another controversial opinion. That's not controversial. But yeah, you're right. You're right. The escalation's there. Even from just beginning to end of this film itself, ending with the queen at the end, it screams escalation. And I love how everything's set up as well. As a screenwriting nerd specifically, seeing how every scene sort of has a payoff later on, whether it is the loading docks and showing that she knows how to use the big forklift construction suit thing that she's going to use to fight the monster later on, or if it's going through the specifics of how each weapon works. That's something that video games do. Movies don't really do that, but this movie, every single weapon, every piece of artillery that they have is unique and specific, and you can tell what the purpose and the use of it is. I love seeing how the Marines' understanding of what they're facing evolves as well. So at first, you know, the xenomorph head is right by them, and then he blows the head off of the alien, and then the blood spews all over him and it burns someone's arm off pretty much. And then later on, you get the scene where the facehuggers are attacking Ripley and Newt, and then the Marines are able to say, okay, I'm holding this thing now. I know it's going to blow acid in my face if we blow it up here. I'm going to throw it there. Then you're going to shoot it. They're planning it as they're going. It's escalation not only of scale and stakes, but also of understanding and complexity of how we're dealing with these problems. And the scene where they're coming up through the like ventilation shafts on top is also just golden. The fact that they have the motion tracker there is such the perfect piece of horror action, being able to build up tension in a scene with something so simple, just that beeping noise escalating, getting quicker and quicker as they get closer.
I was looking at Masterclass has, I think there was one with James Cameron, and he talks a lot about Alien, and he talks a lot about like Terminators in there as well. But he has this formula where to build suspense up a little bit more, he would show the character's face of what they're seeing before he actually shows what they're like looking at. Yeah. So it'd be like their reaction, and then you can see what they're looking at. And then after that, you see what they're actually looking at.
Yeah,
so it builds up a little bit more. Yeah, you see it in their eyes. Like their eyes shift a little bit when you actually see that moment of realization. Yeah.
When he went up to check the vents to see that the xenomorphs are coming up through the ceiling, that's exactly what happened. You see the vent pop up, you see his head look over, and then he goes, oh shit. And then you see they're right there in front of him. It's fantastic. And Cece Ice, who we had on the show as well, she mentioned that Aliens and T2 as well were her two like seminal childhood. These inspired me to do action films. And it was striking to me, and probably to a lot of action fans, if you know these franchises at all, those are the ones where the female character becomes empowered. And this one especially, you know, and take this however you will, this is obviously a franchise that is very much designed around these fears of like sexual invasion and things like that. And then Alien comes through. You have this woman going through this traumatic experience. Beginning of Aliens, the sequel, you have a bunch of people telling her, we don't believe that you went through this traumatic experience. And then the rest of the film was her having to deal with that, then eventually rebuild her power and her control over the situation and reassert herself. So take that metaphor however you will, but that is a very progressive sort of an arc for a female character to have, not only at this time, but for this genre too. It's a sci-fi horror and then a sci-fi horror action movie. So to be able to do that with Ripley's character was pretty amazing as well.
It's incredible. We talked about elevated horror. I would say that James Cameron is almost elevated popcorn flicks. If you look at the pedigree, whether it's Aliens, Terminator 2, The Abyss, even to a certain extent, Titanic, you know, True Lies. It was one of those things where even True Lies was a response to, he went to the Broccoli's and MGM and he's like, I'd like to make a James Bond movie. And they're like, eh. So he made True Lies. And I think that's cool. Like Terminator was his first real, I mean, you could count Piranha 2, The Spawning, but supposedly he kind of ghost directed that. And then once he blew up, they're like, yeah, put his name on it. Like, you know, he's famous now, so it'll be good. But the reality of it is that James Cameron really is a bit of the architect as far as what we would see in modern cinema. Because I saw Aliens as a kid and I saw it in the theater. My parents, you know, back in the 80s, they used to just take it anything. You know, like it was, I mean, it was a heyday of action, whether it was The Running Man, it didn't matter. It was, if it was violent, no one cared. It was, you know, little kids in movie theaters. But I will tell you, seeing Aliens blew people through the theater. One of my favorite things is that I'm able to remember seeing these movies because they made such an impact on me. And that energy, that excitement, it's just, it's electric and it's not tangible. And Aliens is, it's just such a, it's beautiful. You've got this whole mother-daughter thing. And again, you know, the first film is pretty much a straight horror science fiction movie, but we get to see the final girl trope, but it's a little bit put on its head. You know, there weren't a lot of female action heroes in 87. Well, let's face it. Like what else was really, you know, what else was going on? But even now, and it's a testament to this elevated popcorn genre and to Aliens, they just did, what is it? Aliens Fireteam, which just got released game, this year.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's squad based, so I won't be playing it. But, and I'll tell you, people, we've been talking about the red flags lately. A big red flag, if someone tells you they don't like Aliens, you just stop. Just don't get involved with those people. They're bad people. They're not your, yeah, not your friends.
Not worth it. And again, that's like a testament to some of the design they have here too, that you can make so many video games. And there have been a lot of games made from the Alien franchise because those Marines are so well fleshed out as characters. And then also the mechanics of how they do what they do and the weapons they use. I remember playing through, I think they made an Alien versus Predator game. And I was
they've made many.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
I think it was the second one that they had come out. I was playing that. I had family over though, and they wanted to turn on the TV and watch something. And I'm trying to communicate to them that I'm up to the alien queen and she's almost down. Like, I just had to figure out how to do it, and I was not able to figure it out in time. So I had to go back and then reclaim that victory. But yeah, that was a red flag. So I just never talked to my family again over that because they did not show the appreciation.
Rightfully so.
Yeah.
I think that family's the backbone of all culture and all, but fuck them. That's it. You're not. Yeah, you got to get out. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to jump in with one more horror action movie that we had on the docket here. Freddy versus Jason.
Welcome to my nightmare.
We're not safe awake or asleep.
Hope you die.
From 2003, directed by, who directed this? Ronnie Yu?
Oh, yeah. Which Hong Kong director?
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Okay.
Iconic Hong Kong, like he did a Chinese ghost story, and they were hoping that maybe some of that kinetic action. I mean, the easiest comparison is to say that he's essentially like the Chinese Sam Raimi, you know, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. Maybe Sam Raimi is the American Ronnie Yu.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
a lot of the camera angles and the shots, I only saw like one of the scenes from this movie. It was like one of the fight scenes, I think. And then it seemed very Robert Rodriguez kind of Sam Raimi, like you were saying, like the camera would follow the knife and wacky angles and all that stuff like that. And I was kind of surprised to see that in Freddy versus Jason movie, but it was interesting. I don't really know. I don't really have an opinion on the full movie, just that one scene. So,
oh man, I feel so conflicted about it, but I was such a big fan of mostly Nightmare on Elm Street, but also the Friday the 13th franchise when I was younger. So when this came out, of course, I was all over it. Or when I heard about it later on, it had already come out by the time I got around to those franchises. But part of me feels like I'm really disappointed that it wasn't a lot better than it was. But part of me also feels like it is exactly what it needed to be. We got, and this is something that I believe was in development hell for quite a while. And they were going back and forth on all different scripts. And then we settle on this. And I think overall the premise here is pretty solid. Like it makes sense enough. You have a rivalry that kind of makes sense between the two big baddies. You get both iconic locations of Elm Street and then Camp Crystal Lake. You get some really decent fight scenes between the two. You get some interesting plays on the fight scenes with the different dream realm logic and with the different psychological components of Freddy trying to get into Jason's head. And if we check all those boxes, that's kind of all I really need from this movie. I'll just fast forward to the parts that interest me again and then get through it in 30, 40 minutes.
There's a book called, and I recommend it. It's called Slash of the Titans. Mm. And it basically covers the history and trajectory of the Freddy vs. Jason movie. It was in development hell for over a decade. And the reality of that was just like, first of all, Alien vs. Predator gets made because of Freddy vs. Jason. It brings interest back to the versus thing. And I think the versus thing is always good. But the problem is that you end up, it's kind of like if you do half and half flavors, if you do chocolate and vanilla, it must be perfectly ratioed. But ultimately, sometimes the chocolate overpowers the vanilla. And I feel like that's what happens with a versus movie. You either get the alien right or you get the predator. You know, like one of them works more than the other. And I felt like Freddy was good. It was very much more a Nightmare on Elm Street movie than a Jason movie. I like it. It was one of those things where I tell people who grew up, especially in the 80s with these characters, the movie that's in your head or the movie that you discussed on the playground with your friends is far better than anything that they will give you. You know, because that's what it's all about. It's, you know, could the leprechaun fight Chucky? Could Michael Myers, you know, take Pinhead? And that's really the secret. You know, I think Freddy vs. Jason is just like this weird time capsule because I think that's 2003.
Yeah, 2003. Mm.
It is. It has the most 2003 ass soundtrack on earth. It's pretty much all metal. I think it's like Razorblade Records. I'm probably screwing. It was Roadrunner. Excuse me. It was Roadrunner Records. Okay. And it was like, you know, it just go listen to it. It's like I can't do it justice, kids. But the fact of the matter is that wow. I mean, the hardest part for me, like I went back and I watched it recently, and Kelly Rowland from Destiny's Child has this hard, she uses the hard F word, which is a derogatory term for a person who is gay. And it's a word that we just need to get out of the vernacular of people. And I'm like, ooh, this did not age well.
Yeah, you know? No, it didn't.
It's just that there's the other thing like too. It's like, well, we couldn't get Beyonce. Who can we get? Get us the other girl from Destiny's Child. Which one? Ah, who cares? Kids love it. Because that was very much a part, you know, at the time, like it was like, I think that the role for Busta Rhymes was original in Halloween Resurrection was written for LL Cool J and like three other people. And I guess it's like, it's kind of a scale, like with Freddy vs. Jason, they wrote that part, I think, for Christina Aguilera. And it was like, well, we can't get her. So let's go down the pop, you know?
And see who we can
down
get.
The chain.
Yeah, what was their character supposed to do? I didn't see the full thing. So,
which character?
That like the character that Christina Aguilera was supposed to play, but was replaced by Destiny's Child.
She was basically, it was the same exact character where it was like, oh, I don't think I'm pretty.
Okay.
It was the insecure character. And I think it would have been even more ridiculous with Christina Aguilera. She sticks out like a sore thumb. This was my point that I want to go back to really quickly with like Dwayne Johnson. Sorry, I got to segue into this. Mm. It's distracting. Like Dwayne Johnson is great. Yes. I love him. But once you put Dwayne Johnson into a movie, I'm out. Or because he's not, I don't care if he's playing Black Adam. He's good at one role. And that's Dwayne Johnson,
yeah. And I'm worried.
And that's all you can really see
Adam.
Is Dwayne Johnson. Yeah.
I don't know how he's going to play someone who isn't absurdly positive and upbeat as Black Adam. So I'm a little bit worried there. I know they had the little clip just released from, I think DC Fandom had a clip from Black Adam, but they didn't really show him acting as Black Adam. So I'm still a little on the fence about it. But then on the flip side of things, though, you have something like Tusk from Kevin Smith, and you have Johnny Depp in that film, and he's in really good prosthetics to the point where he doesn't look weird. You can tell he's still a human being, but that plus his acting chops and his accent and everything, it's kind of hard to tell he's Johnny Depp at first glance. You might get some Johnny Depp energy from his performance, but it's not that distracting. So you don't 100% realize it's him right away.
And with Charlie and Chocolate Factory a little bit, or no? is it very, very Johnny Depp there? Actually, when I was a kid, I didn't know it was him, but then I was like, it still gave me like the vibe, you know?
I wasn't cognizant of who Johnny Depp, the actor, was when it first came out. And I you just totally blew my hair back. I was not expecting a Charlie and the Chocolate Factory poll for this particular podcast, but I guess that is like pretty Johnny Depp cranked up to 100.
Yeah.
Man, yeah, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Shouts to that movie.
Yeah.
Shouts to that movie. Also kind of horrific, some things that go on in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, it's like mildly disturbing, but it's...
Yeah, kind of just murdering children.
It's funny too, because like Depp, he pretty much based his performance on Michael Jackson. And like once I knew that, I'm like, oh, I can never see this movie the same way again.
That is true, yeah.
And it's like, it's funny because we went from Gene Wilder to Johnny Depp. Now they're doing Timothy Chalamet.
And
he's supposed to be like the sexy, whimsical version of Willy Wonka. I mean, look, man, it was the same thing. Like the Dwayne Johnson effect is the same thing that we talked about with Angelina Jolie in The Eternals. It's like, oh, it's Angelina Jolie. It takes me out of it.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is Dwayne Johnson needs to do something like John Travolta did with Pulp Fiction, where it's like, I don't know. It's
totally
hard,
out of left
though.
Field.
Even like in End of Days, Arnold Schwarzenegger was supposed to be an alcoholic. Nobody has a body like that who's an alcoholic.
Yeah, who's an alcoholic.
Get out of here.
You know, he had to do a whole body transformation, everything. Yeah, if he was really going to sell that.
Worth it to do a body transformation almost ever. I mean, props to everyone who does it in the acting
props
world.
Props to Christian Bale. His whole commitment.
Oh, my God. That's
He's going to drop dead at 58. Stuff. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
So sorry.
No, you're right. Like, it takes such a physical toll on you. It's not even a subjective thing. It's just objectively, you're going to live a probably shorter life and a less healthy life to some extent. Your joints are going to feel it. Your metabolism's going to feel it.
Essentially dying for his craft,
as he says.
Yeah.
Freddy vs. Jason is a very weird film. Like I said, it's a complete time capsule of 2003. But I was just thinking to myself, like, I want to say it's more of a point of innocence, but like, could we do Freddy vs. Jason now? I think we could. And I think it would be like enough, almost 20 years has passed. Like, we could do it again, right?
Yeah, and you know, the Friday the 13th reboot.
Coming back.
Both remakes, actually. They were pretty good. They were better than they had any right to be.
I
both of them. I don't know if that's enough of two franchises coming together to butt heads at the end, but if you just made a Freddy vs. Jason movie based on the characters, not necessarily the reboot franchises, I'm down for it. And I'm also fascinated at how we're kind of Hollywood's hitting a better stride in terms of how they're rebooting, reviving older franchises again. I know a lot of people don't like that. They say, oh, there's no new ideas in Hollywood anymore. But then they go to buy the Marvel tickets and no other tickets. And then they ask themselves why they don't see anything new. But that is I'm interested. Yeah, bringing back that sort of A versus B franchise.
Sometimes it's the only place to go. When a franchise is run out of steam, you're like, what can we do? Oh, I got an idea. You know, like, and that's kind of where you get to that point where it's like, well, we have them fight, because eventually that's what the original Universal Monsters did. They were like, okay, we've made three Frankenstein films. What have we not done yet? He'll meet the Wolfman. And I like those old casual titles, like Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. Like, yeah, he meets them. They go out for coffee.
Yeah. Yeah. What does meet really mean?
I want the Mario convention of naming, where it's Freddy versus Jason and then new Freddy versus Jason, like new Super Mario Bros.
Oh, yeah, new.
I like that.
Or bring back do the video game subtitles where it's like Revengeance or something like that.
I like that too. How would you like to be the head of New Line Cinema? You know, it's like
shouts to New Line. Shouts to New Line.
Yeah, New Line, that Blade was a New Line joint. Mm-hmm. And it was the house that Freddie built. I'm going to tell you this because I'm trying to tell every person that's listening. Robert Englund, who plays Freddy Krueger, is still alive. He doesn't want to go back in the makeup because he's a grampy. And look, I understand. I'm going to be a grampy. We'll all be grampy someday.
Yeah.
And you're not going to want to put on 4 hours of latex, whatever it is. Do an animated series for HBO. And I think that's where you go with A Nightmare on Elm Street now. Because you have no budget. You have unlimited.
And he could still voice it and everything.
Bang.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. And they had a Nightmare on Elm Street series, did not do super well. A lot of it kind of was not that great. But I remember the first episode of that, the pilot, was pretty good. And they did a sort of Perfect Blue type thing where you're not sure where the dream ends and where the reality begins again. And it's this, I think it followed one of the cops that was on the case who helped Freddy in life. And it was interesting. It wasn't perfect, but there's potential there with the whole dream logic aspect, that sort of Twin Peaksy feel to it.
Surreal.
I could dig that. Yeah, the whole surreal dream logic aspect to it. Mm-hmm. I could dig that.
It's crazy because that first episode of Freddy's Nightmares was directed by Toby Hooper, who directed the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Poltergeist. Oh, wow. Because I swear to God, your listeners are going to learn something. I'm just like, it's like nutrition. I'm trying to pack as much nutrition. I can't stop. I'm sorry. It never ends.
Yeah, I mean, you have the knowledge, so.
I got to use it for something. We always talk, if there was like a Jeopardy that was about pop culture or films, somebody's about to make some money.
Yeah, someone.
Someone. Yeah. Maybe not me, but somebody.
With that, I think that's a pretty good place to wrap up here. If we or anyone listening wanted to follow you or your podcast, where could they go?
You can find The Offering with Jerry Hara pretty much anywhere you go. Spotify seems to be the most popular. People love Spotify. There's a YouTube. So if you want to sit down and use YouTube, you can listen to all the episodes. As far as social media, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, I'm on TikTok, at Jerry Hara. That's where you can find me. But The Offering is the name of the show, and it's pretty much always horror, always genre. First of all, I've listened to a couple episodes of this show, and you guys have a fantastic show. I really enjoy it.
Thank
because
you.
I'm an action nerd,
Yeah.
So, yeah, man, I mean, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you. And like I said, as I just wrapped up the first season, I'm going to be doing some more interesting things in the second season, and I think that's where we could use some gentlemen like you.
Amazing.
Looking forward to it. Looking forward.
Definitely.
To it. Thank you so much for hopping on.
My pleasure.
If you liked that, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/actionfilmmaking and leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. Stay up to date on the show by visiting our website, actiondecoded.com, and by following us on Instagram at actionfilmmakingpodcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.